Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, what a Pulitzer Prize-winning play has to say about race, privacy, faith, and identity. Our roundtable went to see Disgraced at the Guthrie, and now we've gathered to share some impressions, some insights, and what I think are going to be differing perceptions about the play. If you haven't seen it, a brief word here about the story. We're introduced to a youngish married couple, Amir and Emily, in their Upper East Side apartment. He's a successful lawyer, ambitious, the son of immigrant parents who came to the U.S. from Pakistan. She's an artist, also ambitious, white liberal. I got the feeling she was kind of cosseted. They begin a conversation full of cultural landmines that end up exploding by the end of the play. The play was written by Ayad Akhtar, won the Pulitzer in 2013. Go see it before the end of August at the Guthrie. Our roundtablers today, Marcela Lorca is the director of Disgraced. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Jose Santos is an anthropologist and professor at Metro State University. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me again.
Syl Jones is a playwright and the resident fellow for narrative medicine at HCMC. Welcome back. Always good to have you here, Syl.
Thank you, Curie.
Marcela, what would you add to the scene setter that is essential to understand about the story as we talk about the play? Anything?
Well, the story revolves around Amir Kapoor, who was a successful corporate lawyer in New York City in 2011.
Mm-hmm. That is important to know, isn't it? That it's 2011, a certain number of years after 9/11.
Yes, it's definitely post 9/11 America in New York City, and he's hidden his true identity in order to succeed in a firm. So his true identity and his roots are from Pakistani origin, and he decides to change his name from Abdullah to Kapoor in order to appear Indian. And that's very important to him.
Yeah, he is married to a white... I am right in my description of liberal, ambitious artist.
A visual artist, yeah.
Right,
yeah. A successful visual artist who is anchoring her work in also the tradition of Islam. She's really taken by the forms of Islamic art, so she's really pursuing her own version of what that means for her.
Jose, what's important to understand about this pair? The way this couple's come together.
I think it's the collision of social groups here. The collisions of social groups in a very kind of, how can I not use the word postmodern, but in a context, a post 9/11 context where identity is so loaded and yet so confusing, it's so uncertain. So you've got on the one hand, this gentleman that comes from a Muslim tradition, has a Muslim background, and he's the one that through the play is bashing Islam the most. And then you have this white woman, this white liberal woman, who is the one that is defending it, right? So earnestly, right, throughout it. And I think that's not so far from reality. It sounds like a flip, right? But I think that's the kind of thing that happens in the kind of context we're living in, where people's identities, you can feel good and bad about them at the same time. And at the same time, you feel this need to evaluate other identities, right? And so she's doing that, right? She is looking at Islam, right? And as much as she's not judging it negatively, she's still evaluating it. She's still making sense of it and trying to say, this is what Islam is. It's this beautiful kind of progressive thing. And then he's bashing it the whole time. And so all these things that people have inside them, you know, who you are, where you come from, they're in a context nowadays where it's really heated and it's really painful. And I think, you know, we're right to point out, why did he have to hide this? I think that's a really central question, and I think it's a human one. We were talking a little bit earlier. It's a universal one. Everybody's got to hide a piece of their identity, but why? And I think where we can take it now into, you know, the 21st century is like, why does it have to be a Muslim identity that's the ones that's hidden in this play?
The other thing, Syl, that I experienced was a kind of whiplash. I felt like every time I had the character nailed, I'd have that experience in the play, oh, now I think I understand what this is about. And then the character would show me something else that kind of upended my expectations. Did you have the similar experience?
I did. When I read the script, I felt that way, and when I saw the production, too. Before we get off into all the political stuff, though, I think it's really important to understand. From my perspective, I was really disappointed with these characters.
You mean the way they're drawn in the play?
Now, just the fact that I wouldn't want to spend the night with any of them. I thought they were all duplicitous, as that's a word that's used in the script. But you also wonder about, in the sacred relationship of marriage, you know, how much have these two people really shared with each other?
Well, that's kind of the point, right?
Yeah.
He's kept a lot of himself hidden from her.
And so has she to some degree.
Well, there's a line of the play when she says, you know, we never talk about these things, not really. And I think that that's a key line, that there are certain parts of particularly his religion or his background that they're not talking about. And they're not talking about what's truly important intimately. But they're sharing plenty of other things, and they love each other. And I happen to love these characters because I think that everybody in the play is innocent in their pursuit of something greater than themselves and trying to achieve something great. And that, like many of these characters, the world is populated by complex human beings that have two or three sides of themselves playing at the same time. So I think it really reflects humanity and how we operate. We're not all, you know, perfect. We're very complex human beings that have a lot of great things and not so great things.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
So you think that Emily is innocent? Because Emily absconds essentially with the Muslim identity that Amir discards, right? I don't get a sense of who she really is at all. Meaning, what is her background? Where does she come from? What is her cultural identity aside from her black Spanish boyfriend, which she had beforehand, which she takes something from? And then from Amir, she takes a lot from something that perhaps could even make her famous, according to the script, right?
Yeah, I mean, in our interpretation of the play, Emily is a person of great privilege that has grown up with a great education, great access, great relationships, and that has been able to travel the world and look at art in different cultures and really fall in love really spiritually and intimately with forms that are not part of their culture, and that she feels the right to draw from those cultures in deep respect and honor to that culture.
Right. What we would call in anthropology cultural appropriation.
Yes.
She basically just reached out, oh, that's pretty. She reached out, grabbed it, and said, oh, well, now I'll make it mine because I understand it better than they do.
Right.
She's literally arguing with a person of Muslim background about what it means to be Muslim and what Islam is.
The other thing, just to say this, since we're talking about the combination of the two, I wondered if she would have ever dated and married him if he hadn't been hiding a part of himself from himself and her, and if he had been as open about what he gets pretty open about towards the end of the play.
I like playing with that dilemma because I think on one hand it gets back to what Syl was saying, is like there's parts of this that I don't like about these people.
Yeah.
And I think it's that they left their identities and their relationships with each other at a pretty superficial level.
Right.
Right. Like the beginning of the play, I honestly thought I was going to be bored because they're being all cutesy and everything like that. And they're like, you know, they have these New York lifestyles and they're talking about their privileged dilemmas and they're just like, you know, playing around on the couch and everything. Which kind of lulls you into like, oh, they have this cute little relationship and everything like that, which, you know, of course, is foreshadowing like something bad's going to happen here. But, you know, I'm not, you know, ignorant playgoer. I'm just sort of like watching. I was like, oh, no, another one of these stories about these people living in New York. And then you realize because they haven't really developed a deep relationship where they've shared openly, that has to be a farce.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a farce. It's nothing but the most superficial thing. So is there love? Yeah, absolutely. Is there is there real affection between these people? Absolutely. Can that withstand, right, the anguish and the pain of revealing their true selves? And it turns out it can't, right? Or at least not in the context of this play. And so I think on the one hand, one lesson for all of us as people is don't do that, right? Like if there's this deep, deep, dark secret, it is who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It is a part of who you are. And don't be you don't have to be ashamed of it, right? And if you think you're with a partner that can't handle that, you need a different partner.
Yeah, but Marcella said just a minute ago, and I think you agreed with this, that we all have
we
those
all
parts of our identities that we don't necessarily want to show. to someone else.
Is it true that we don't have... I mean, I think I resist that because I don't want that to be true, so I'm going to be honest about that. I don't want that to be true. But in America today, in the 21st century, a lot of the political pressures we experience and the social and economic pressures we experience make it hard for some of us to reveal our true identities, right? I mean, that's what part
and,
of the
and
point
I think
saying.
That we reveal different parts of our identities in different settings at different times. I think that we use what we know, you know, we'll be comfortable in that setting, and we try to make people comfortable with us in whatever setting that we are.
Yeah.
So I think we pick and choose, and we all have sort of multiple relationships with, you know, particularly for those of us who come from different cultures, have different sort of relationships with the different parts of this culture.
I mean, yeah. Just to say this, Jose, I think what Marcelo just said, that's the sense I got from Amir, that this wasn't an entirely selfish act, although it did allow him to kind of walk through the world maybe in an easier way. But he also felt like he was smoothing things for the people around him, like especially in his law firm, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And right. Obviously, you know, it's better for his wife this way, right?
Right,
and it's better.
Right.
And I think we have the symbol of, like, he's got this nephew who did the same thing, who changed his name to, like, what was it? Abe Jensen. Right, just this very kind of Wonder Bread kind of name.
Right.
I think as far as, you know, sharing or not sharing, I think we're very right when we point out that it is there's a choice involved. And so I guess where I think I have the problem is, why is there so much shame around that choice? Sometimes we do open up, and I think there are people, I know I personally have come to, when it comes to things like, you know, my masculinity or my Latino background or whatever, there's parts that you want to share at certain times and parts you want to share at other times, but there's parts that are always shameful. It's always hard. And so it's about, you know, who are the safe people I can share this with? And I think these were people that weren't safe in their most intimate relationships.
That's right. And that's the thing that bothers me. That's the central, to me, it's the central human quality question in the play. It's like, can we find ways to share even with our most intimate partners?
Well, I think
ourselves.
one of the things that's interesting is that these people assume that they know each other and that they know each other intimately, and that because they share liberal leaning views and because they're ambitious and they're successful and they're in a particular world, that they of course they understand each other and of course they share each other, and even if they have opposing views, they can be free to express themselves. But when push comes to shove, people revert back to their tribal instincts and their tribal understanding, and they will go back to basic things about their own culture that is in clash with another person's perspective.
I'd like to comment on that since we're using the word tribal, is that I think people think of it as a cultural problem, and in some ways, culture is how it's expressed, but it's a very human defensiveness
right.
about us and them. And culture is just how your particular society has figured out who us and who them is. But all of these people were basically triggered on that level, right? There's a great discussion afterwards that was led by someone from the Islamic Resource Group, and we talked about how one of the major problems with this or any discussion of race is just how insecure people are. They're not speaking from a place of security. They're speaking from that place of shame where you got to hide stuff. And so, of course, when people are saying something that gets just a little too close, you're too insecure to be able to just say, oh, okay, well, that's what they needed to say right there. Or this is just part of the discussion. You have to rush to a defense. You have to rush to an insult. You've got to rush to. And I think we're not taught how to check ourselves on that. That's not something our education system does.
Well,
right?
If we're not going to be authentic, it's very difficult to have those conversations, too, right. From a place of authenticity and strength, being able to stand up for who you are in the face of. And if you're going to be predatory, too, which I consider almost all of these characters to be in more one way or another, that's also very difficult because then you can't be authentic. You're trying to get something out of the other person,
right.
Out of the world, out of life. And, you know, you might step on other people to get there.
Right. To politicize it, where I think there's a good example of this, like in the social sphere. If you look at, I'll just say three statements to give you an idea of how this works. Black lives matter. All lives matter. Blue lives matter. And I think what happened in the discourse is somebody couldn't just say one of those statements and for it to be okay for other people to try and understand it. There had to be this response, but what about, because it's treading on these identities that are very sensitive to people.
And you know all this, that
right.
That rush to equivalency doesn't understand the history that feeds Black Lives
absolutely
Matter,
not.
Right?
Absolutely not. No, it doesn't. What I'm talking about is our knee-jerk human impulse,
yeah.
Our knee-jerk us and them. Well, one of them said something, so one of us has to get back
exactly.
in there, and now it's a fight, right? And I think what we see in a microcosm is what this happens between individual people in this play. I mean, there were parts where my stomach hurt. I felt like I'd been punched in the gut because of how these people were going after each other. I thought it was brilliant. I really just want to say that right now. I thought that it was a brilliant play, and it hurt to watch because there's parts of your own identity. I think there's very few people that can watch this and won't have something triggered from something in their own background. And I think on the one hand, it is very social and political, but on the other hand, it is so uniquely individually human. It is something I think on some level every individual can relate to. But once we take it to the social stage, we can realize, my God, what are we doing to each other?
Yeah.
I mean, what I love about this conversation is that everybody will see the play through their own lens and through their own experience. And that's been, you know, when we sit in the post-play discussions, there's so much diversity of opinions. And not one thing, not one person is seeing the same thing.
You know, will you understand this when I say I'm not sure that I entirely believed Amir's resorting to the tribal part of his nature. So it seemed like such a rejection of everything, such a fast rejection of this whole foundation that he'd kind of built for himself. And then all of a sudden, he's just right there again.
Well, I think that, you know, the events of the play and the revelations that happen in the play have pushed him to an edge. And he finds himself at this dinner party sharing some views that he should have never aired in the company that he's at.
And we should say one of those views is that he has a certain sympathy for the views of the people that crashed into the Twin Towers, for the terrorists.
Yes, you're saying too much, Carrie.
Am I? Sorry. But, you know, I think we should explain that.
I think we have to be careful about saying he has sympathy for them. He said something like, because we were finally winning is what he was saying. And so if you feel like you've been losing for generations, whatever that means, and something happens that your people start to rejoice about, even if it's something that's inappropriate, you might feel a certain kind of affinity for that feeling. And in those circumstances of the play, he was expressing that almost as a way of liberating himself from this facade that he had put over himself.
Yeah.
And yet the response was to shame him.
Yes.
The response was, you're not allowed to have that feeling.
Right.
Well, that was
right.
Isaac who,
right,
you know.
Right, right. And then he tries and flips it on Isaac, right? And so Isaac's Jewish, right? So that we can let the audience know if they haven't seen it. But and then tries and flips it, says, don't you feel good when, you know, Israel cracks down or does this or does that or hands it to their enemies? And then Isaac, of course, rejects it outright.
Yeah, all those assumptions are interesting. And I started thinking about, okay, this play is set in New York. And if this play were set in Minneapolis,
I had the exact same question.
This conversation would never have happened. And it's not because people wouldn't have felt the same way, or it maybe wouldn't even have been because three of the people in the play haven't shared bodily fluids, but because no one would have gone there.
Nobody would have talked about it. Yeah.
No one would have gone there.
And that's very important. And it was very important for me to sort of give a sensibility of New York to the audience so that to remind them, you know, you're not in Minnesota. This is a particular world at a particular time, Upper East Side apartment, very fancy place, a lot of power. All those people have a lot of power in that world.
I'm curious, what are things that you think you did, whether consciously or looking back, might have been effective, in particularly reaching a Minnesota audience? Because there is that cultural reservation around having conversations like this. So how do you get through to a group that's unique in that way?
Well, a technical aspect that for me was very important was the use of sound, for example. And it was important for me to to have a sound that was unifying and that was empathetic of the character, the central character of Amir. So we investigated quite a bit the quality of the music, the emotionality of the music, to allow the audience to sort of get into Amir's shoes and stay with them all the way through the play.
Well,
Marcella, what if the, and this was going through my mind as I was watching the play, what if the key element of this wasn't terrorism, but what if it, I mean, I hear rhetoric like this in the political campaign around immigration. I mean, people will say things about, I'm sure you have too, people will say things about immigration that startles me. What if we'd put that in the center as the element that everybody's kind of tiptoeing around, but then, you know, slowly revealing? I think you could have had that anywhere in this country. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think what's true is that the play was written way before the political campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think that what the playwright is really wrestling with are issues that revolve around what does it mean to be Muslim American,
yes,
in the reality right now. And since then, since the time that he wrote it, now we're at a very pointed time.
True.
Where there's a huge discussion about what does it mean.
I mean, you know what was going mm-hmm. through my head was Donald Trump's announcement a year ago June, in which he pronounced most Mexicans criminals and rapists. That the tenor of that language is not all that different.
Yeah,
in
when
what
I heard,
happened in this.
When I heard Amir speaking, I immediately went to like, oh, here's more Trump speech. And what was fascinating to me is in the conversation after the play, there were a lot of people talking about, you know, they saw the political side, they saw the individual side, but nobody said they saw a parallel with our own political situation right
really?
Now with the presidential election. So I kind of raised my hand. I was like, look at this disaster that we're looking at on stage. That's what we got in the public view. And it is this conversation of shaming the other guy and who is us and who is them.
Right.
And everybody should feel bad about it. And it's impossible to have a conversation about it.
I just as a playwright want to defend the script, okay, and the writer of the script without these times that we're living in. Although I think the beauty of this play is that it speaks to America right here, right now, at this instance.
Yeah.
Okay. But the whole thing is to try to, I don't want to bring Trump into every discussion we have these days about political differences or differences around identity and culture.
Well,
because
doesn't he
Trump
belong
isn't worthy
in this
of
conversation
that. He isn't really worthy of that. Where that's not the play is not about Trump. The play is about a guy who really has bought into American capitalism. Okay, he really has bought into
Amir.
It.
Yeah.
Amir,
yes,
right. And so he has a scheme about how he's going to get ahead in American capitalism. And one part of that scheme is being the lawyer. But then he's got the blonde white wife and everything else. And there's a facade about all of that. And what the play really says to me is that he can't do it. In this society, the capitalist society we live in, he is prevented from doing that.
Well,
it's not just by Donald Trump. It's by a lot of things.
You see him right from the beginning. I mean, he's really at the glass ceiling. He's at the top of his career.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing that should happen to him is that he's made partner of that firm.
Yep.
And he's worked more than anybody else,
yep,
you know, to get there. And the play unravels in such a way that that becomes impossible for him.
Yeah, he's trapped.
So excuse me, yeah, but why? Because the whole idea about hard work doesn't really apply to him. If he were white, or Jewish, maybe even, the play insinuates, it would apply to him. He would be a partner.
Right.
But it doesn't work for him. And that's about the unraveling of the capitalist myth.
Right. And it's because it happens because his true identity gets revealed.
Right.
And the fact that he's concealed it, of course, gets him in hot water.
Mm-hmm.
And because he happened to happen an imam, and with charges of terrorism in New York City, which is a really dangerous thing to do for somebody in his position.
True.
And his name ends up in print.
I'm going to say I do think Trump belongs into the middle of this conversation because we're all examining and arguing and I hope wrestling with the idea of what it means to be an American. What how do we see our own identities and then how do we see ourselves collectively? Yeah. Boy, this play speaks right to that, Syl. And Donald Trump has a very specific vision today of what it means to be American.
Well, let me be clear. I'm not saying we should ignore Donald Trump in the real world. I'm saying that this play takes us to a world that was before all
of
that.
Yes, understood.
And because it does that, I want to protect the playwright's right to have written the play at the time he did.
I understand.
Yeah. But he's so great
because he's raising issues that are so relevant
today. That are timely.
Today.
Yes.
Right.
And I think part of it is, in some ways, I get the point. It's not about Trump because Trump is a person. He's a human being and he's just some guy. But the reason he's in the position he's in is because we've got a series of social problems. A series of social problems, of conflicts, of competing identities and economics, and the kind of the problem with capitalism that you point out so well, Syl. So I think in some ways this play is kind of an omen of what's to come.
Yeah.
Because he understood that the author saw the conflict was there. The conflict was always there. And Trump just happens to be the wall dressing around how that conflict is being expressed right now.
Yeah.
Well, what's great about the play is that we all have Trump in our minds right now. And we're living in that time where he's really creating divisions between cultures in order to gain power. And the play is inviting us to a conversation and examination of, like, what are these divisions and are we really divided? And are we all connected by just a deep sense of humanity? And aren't we all human beings that face discrimination of different kinds at different points in our lives and history? And the conversation after the play have been so rewarding and refreshing because you realize there's really smart, intelligent human beings that are wrestling with these issues and that are deeply affected by the conversation of politics right now and that really want to speak their voice.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable here. We all went to see the play Disgraced. We also have the director with us on the roundtable. It's playing at the Guthrie through the end of August. We watched the play through our own life experience and our own ideas, and now we've come to the roundtable to bring those ideas. And we saw the play differently among the three of us, which is leading to a very spirited conversation, which is great. Marcela Lorca with us. She's director of Disgraced. Jose Santos with us, an anthropologist at Metro State University. Syl Jones, a playwright and resident fellow for narrative medicine at HCMC. We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll come back. We'll start the conversation again. Stay with us. But first, a look at the latest.
Good morning, Carrie. I'm Phil Picardi in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Donald Trump says his description of President Obama as a founder of the Islamic State group was sarcasm. Trump claims Obama's foreign policy decisions helped give birth to the terrorist group, and he has called Obama the founder of ISIS. Trump has been criticized for his choice of words, but in a tweet today, he says the critics don't get sarcasm. Authorities in Thailand aren't sure who was behind bombing attacks that struck several popular resort cities and beach towns today and yesterday, killing four people and wounding dozens of others. Authorities say the attackers used firebombs and homemade explosives when they struck south of Bangkok. Seven of the wounded are foreigners. Authorities in the French resort town of Cannes are getting some criticism for banning full-body, head-covering swimming suits from beaches. Officials say it's because of security concerns. Critics are calling it an anti-Muslim move that will only worsen religious tensions. France remains on edge after deadly Islamic extremist attacks on nearby Nice and on a Catholic church in northwestern France. And the official Chinese news agency Xinhua is reporting that a Chinese swimmer is the first person to test positive for banned substances at the Rio Olympics. The Chinese Swimming Association says the 18-year-old swimmer tested positive for a banned diuretic after she finished fourth in the women's 100-meter butterfly. Yesterday at the Games, American swimmer Michael Phelps won his fourth gold medal of the Olympics. It was the 22nd gold medal of his career. And Simone Manuel won gold in a women's freestyle event. She is the first African-American woman to win gold in the pool. And on the mats and bars yesterday, American Simone Biles won gold for women's gymnastics. Allie Raisman of the U.S. won a silver medal. More news ahead on NPR News. The time is 9:36.
Programming is supported by Securian Financial Group. Securian can help people and businesses achieve financial security for the long run. Learn more at Securian.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to a Friday Roundtable. We did something a little different. We took the roundtable, I guess, out of the studio. I asked two guests to go see the play Disgraced at the Guthrie, and I saw it last Friday night. And now we've come to the roundtable to have a discussion about impressions we had from the play and some of the larger ideas and themes that it speaks to. Marcella Lorca is with us. She's the director of Disgraced, Jose Santos and Syl Jones. Okay, before news, you were just squirming and ready to dive in there, Jose.
Oh,
what did you want to say?
About the conflict that people go through, right? And that we can see in this play, this conflict over identity. And then we were talking about Trump, but I wanted to make the connection. I think why Trump supporters are so forthright in their support of him is because I think they have these conflicts. I think Trump supported, the whole notion of make America great again is that feeling that something has been taken from who you are. Something has been taken from who you are. And you guys took it from us. So I think we're dealing with the same kind of pain, the same kind of shame and suffering. You know, why are we in the position that we're in? And I think in some ways it's because capitalism has failed them. Right. There is this great promise of, America is supposed to be this great thing. My life is supposed to go a certain way. And it just hasn't. And then the easiness of the us and them trope as an explanation of how it is. So I think we need to remember that, right? I think when we're condemning Trump, I don't think we should stop and think, but there's people that are supporting him for the same reasons I'm supporting the causes I'm supporting, and it's because they believe and they're in a period of great conflict and
this is
and
why this way I want to say, and listeners to the show have heard this probably, that when people call in and they say all those Trump people, they're stupid and uneducated, and it's not his support is not monolithic. And I think people bring experiences that, as you say, Jose, feel very real and difficult to them. Now, does that mean the answer to that is the right answer?
No.
I don't think it is.
No,
but
it's not. But, I got news for you guys. Donald Trump would love this play. Because people are speaking their minds, right? They're saying what
they're saying.
There's nobody's, there's no political correctness involved. He'd run out of the play, and I think he'd be really happy that he saw it. Because this guy revealed that this is the way he became a terrorist, which is he got knocked down. He didn't get a chance to be promoted. And at the end, he's left, I think he's having a panic attack, isn't he? On stage.
You mean the character of Abe? Are you talking about?
No, I'm sorry. Not Abe. I'm talking about Amir.
Amir.
Yeah. At the very end, Amir is left without anything, essentially.
He's left without anything, but I truly believe that after you've lost everything, that he has an opportunity to really self-examine
himself. I thought he would be starting
new.
Fresh. Right.
He's starting new.
That it was a good place for him to be.
Hmm. So why didn't he go to the end and open the window and take a deep breath? Instead, he had a panic attack.
Yeah.
No, but he's left at the very end looking at an image of himself painted by his wife. So he's looking at the reflection of his wife, of himself. And I think that he's learning something. He's seeing the reflection. He's seeing the persona that he used to be through somebody else's eyes. And that there's an opportunity now that he's lost everything to really start a life anew and really anchored in a deeper truth.
Mm. Syl, you wanted to talk about the other two people at the dinner party, and this is Isaac and Jory. She is about to become the lead partner at the law firm that Amir works at, and she's married to Isaac.
She's African-American, and in the script, she's described as being almost masculine-looking, which is really interesting. I love the costuming, by the way.
Thank you.
It was beautiful. And then Isaac is just sort of a world-class predator who I think has been traveling the world looking for ways in which he can take advantage of people. But at any rate, the two of them come together and they have an incendiary relationship from the very beginning. There's no respect. I didn't feel any respect or love from the two of them. Is that supposed to be there? Are they supposed to be in love with each other?
I think in our interpretation, I think that there is love for each other, but it's a relationship that's not in a great place. There's consequences to that effect.
Yeah.
I think that they, in my mind, they really respect each other. They both are, in high positions in their jobs. They support each other, and they will defend each other when push comes to shove.
Yeah, I saw them having a relationship and a real one, but I got the same feeling I got from the other relationship between Amir and Emily, that sort of there's a superficial level to this, and if you were to push this far enough, this thing could crumble,
which it
did.
And in the next play, Emily is with Isaac, and they travel the world looking
and they're so
to
happy.
Betray each other.
Yeah,
looking great.
Happily.
And who wants to see that? Because that's just not interesting. Jose, you wanted to talk about the incidents of domestic violence.
Yeah. So there's a scene towards the end, and I'd say kind of one of the real climaxes of the play, where there's a depiction of domestic violence. And I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the director. So some of my background's actually in studying masculinity. And one of the themes that I've wrestled with is domestic violence. So I really want to acknowledge that you did that pretty well.
Thank
for,
you.
For survivors, for things. It's hard to watch that. One thing we really worry about if you're either a survivor or you're somebody that works with people that work with domestic violence is you're very worried about the representation of it. Because so easily people could have looked at this and been, here's another one of these foreign guys beating up on his, you know, his wife, or here's another one of these weak women that doesn't know how to get out of the relationship. Now, obviously, it's impossible to capture the complexity of domestic violence in that very brief scene. I think to do that, you'd need an entire play because you didn't really capture, you know, the pain in the relationship that precedes and that follows these kinds of things around and how you can get trapped in a relationship like this. But I really did want to acknowledge I got nauseous because there was all this tension leading up to it. And then, boom, you hit it. You have this acute moment. And then there's this kind of like explosion, the dust settling. And it finally you finally realize what just happened. And I think it left the audience as confused as victims can be.
Yeah.
With not knowing, what do we even do? How does this even get resolved? And I think a lot of victims look at that being like, This person understood that the audience needs to understand this is going to make no sense. Your brain is going to shut off. You're just going to be left confused and hurt. And then, you know, luckily the way you resolved it is Abe shows up right at that moment and kind of, you know, whisks her away. But so thank you for wrestling with that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think the playwright was very smart in bringing Emily back right away. And I think he struggled with that part of the play as well, and he had that was a way that he resolved it. That we see her coming back, and she's well after that, or relatively well. But that was a part of the play that really scared me when I accepted it to direct the play. I'm like, how am I going to navigate this point, and how do I make sense, and how do I bring the audience along with Amir intimately enough that they're able to understand him through that event, through that very, very hard event, and through that very human event for him and a huge mistake in his life that also, you know, brings his life down to its knees. Yeah. So it's a very charged moment, but, you know, as a director, it's like you can sort of like try to avoid it, or you can try to embrace it and sort of try to really investigate a little bit more deeply all the different aspects of what happens in those cases.
You know, you're making me remember that in that, you know, we're headed for the point of no return. I felt that sense of kind of queasy anticipation that something was going to happen on the stage that nobody was going to be able to step back from. That's not what I thought was going to happen. So is that the play succeeding, or?
Yeah, I think it is.
I
thought was going to happen. And when I read the script, at what point is he going to hit her?
Really?
There's this natural, first of all, the betrayal, the sexual betrayal that occurs in the play. And then the fact that his whole world is crumbling. I thought for sure, because he built his world around her and she, quote, took it away from him, that there would be a physical explosion, all right? So what I looked for in the beginning was the introduction of a gun, but that didn't happen, right? There's no guns in the play.
No guns, no.
So, but I thought there would be something physical that would occur, and I didn't know what that was. So I wasn't surprised by it. I thought it was handled very well. And in the script, it makes it clear that it should be handled behind a couch so that you don't see the whole thing. You see him sort of hit her, but then she goes down and then he hits her again, I think twice.
Right, the most violent part,
I think, is
left
hidden
to the imagination of the audience, which is, I think, what makes
which
it worse
good.
Because our imaginations mm-hmm. can take it so
which
much worse.
Which I think we strayed away a little bit from that stage direction because I was very interested in what was happening to Amir at that point.
Mm.
His turmoil, his violence, his internal violence, his physical violence, the tension erupting, the anger harbored over years and years and years mm-hmm. of repression and oppression, self-oppression,
yep.
that was suddenly just manifesting itself. So I, in my mind, it's not so much that it's geared towards his wife, but that it's that explosion in she's the first target.
Right. And she's in the blast radius, right?
Right.
She's in. I think another thing that this is really something that should go to the playwright, but also the way you directed in the scenes following the abuse is that he remains very human the entire time. And I think one of the things that we do is we sort of, when we think abuser, we immediately do the us-them thing and put them in the category of animal or monster or,
mm-hmm.
you know, not
right.
worth bothering to understand, which is a hindrance both in learning how to end abuse socially and in understanding this is a human problem, right?
I felt complete, I guess it was empathy
yeah.
for him,
yeah.
which I would not, if you had told me this is what's going to happen in this scene, I don't think I would have experienced that. But I've kind of felt that urge. Somebody needs to comfort him, right?
Yeah, he needs help.
Right.
He needs help. This
that's
is a
right.
guy that's hurting and needs help. And then you realize, oh, my God, this is what people do when they're hurting and need help.
Right, right.
And that's something I think that in our quickness to judge and try to evaluate, find a convenient narrative around domestic violence, we ignore. It's a very complex thing, and what it requires is empathy.
Marcella, I want to ask you about a line that I jotted down in the middle of the play. This is Amir talking to his nephew, Abe. Again, he's changed his name and wants to be known as Abe Jensen, and then he rethinks that. But Amir says to him at one point, when you step out of your parents' house, you have to understand it's not a neutral world. Again, just all praise to this playwright for mm-hmm. how relevant that is to today. So knowing
well,
that
dangerous.
Knowing that you're staging this today with all the right. expectations the audience comes to, I want to know how you thought about that.
Oh my God! I mean, I think every day about particularly young men of color, black young men, Muslim young men, brown men. That the moment they step out onto the streets, of course, they have an awareness that the world is not fair to them, that they can run into danger at any point. So it's very, very poignant. This character is profoundly idealistic and innocent in looking for a connection to his own culture, to his own beliefs, in a world that's not so friendly to him. So it's a very complicated reality.
Yeah, and his idealistic demands that he be treated fairly, you know, talking to an older man, his uncle, who knows he's not going to be treated fairly.
Right.
This is something that we repeat almost in a ritual-like fashion in the African-American community, because we see this all the time in the conversation I have with my son, or have had with my son over the years, about the fact that the world is not fair to us, and we have to be very careful, and that the most important thing is that you come back alive at the end of the day. So fairness is something you can sort of litigate, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
reality is reality,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the juxtaposition with the feeling of like, I am an American, I am a free citizen, I should be able to walk down the street and be safe. And I should be able to share my beliefs and be safe. So this juxtaposition with that, with the reality of like, as a fact, you're not. Just because of who you are.
Yeah.
I really liked those interactions between Amir and Abe for the contrast of,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, is cynicism the right word that he has and the idealism of
I think it's realism.
Abe? Is it realism?
For me, it's realism.
Amir's point of view.
Is realistic.
And then what happens when he and Abe, you know, kind of bump up against each other.
He's trying to protect the kid. He's trying to protect his nephew. I think that's the part that's very real to me. But when you take it to the degree that he took it, where he hid his identity in a way that had to come crumbling down on him, right? That's where it became a cynicism where it was unrealistic. One thing that I loved about Abe that I see in something that just young men struggle with is that he was looking the whole play. He wanted somebody to look up to. Whether it was the imam he was trying to defend. No, this guy's great and pure and good and true, and we can't let this happen. Or his own uncle or his friend, right, that gets him busted at the at the Starbucks.
Well, even Emily, who he's confiding in.
Emily,
right,
yeah,
right?
He's desperate to have somebody to look up to. And then there's even a point where I think he tells his uncle, I used to look up to you.
Right.
I used to respect you. And he's lost and he's desperate. And at the end, you know, in some of the things he's angry and saying, you realize, well, maybe now he's starting to idolize. Is he going to idolize Islamic militancy? Is he going to go in that direction simply because there's no role model anywhere else? Right. There's no one he can believe in. Where is he? Where is the great hero that's supposed to mentor him and teach him what's right and what's wrong?
Well, that points out the fundamental failing of American society, though, because we don't provide actually good role models oftentimes for men or women, oftentimes in terms of what success really means and what morality really means. And they don't have to be heroes, you know, then. Football stars or things like that. They just need to be people who are real and have solid values, and they can provide a mentoring hand for a young man like
that. How do you make it through life in a moderately healthy way?
Yes.
Where as few people as possible get hurt, including yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
Marcella, I'm interested in how many cities you've sat in audiences with and seen this play, and kind of what you sense about the differences with the way the audience reacts.
I've actually never seen this play before.
What? Really?
And I'm very grateful that I didn't, because otherwise, as a director, I would have all these images in my mind and these memories that I couldn't shake up. So the great privilege of directing it and being new at it is like we went through a discovery process that was very much our own. And that was a wonderful thing. And I think our production is our production. It's different probably than any other production in any other city.
So if you'd seen it on Broadway, you would have carried the way it was staged and...
Absolutely.
Huh. It's a great way to escape bias.
I didn't realize directors did that.
I don't like to see productions that I'm going to, particularly that I'm going to love. Because then I can't shake those choices off my mind and my imagination. So if I encounter a great play and I've never seen a good production of it, that's a fantastic moment of departure for me, where I'm just free to imagine the world in the way that I'm going to imagine it, with a team of designers that also come at it sort of fresh.
I noticed the notes in the program were that this is the most staged play in America
right now. Yeah.
Yep, it is. Pulitzer Prize winning play. Is it 10 different cities that it's going to appear in? I read that somewhere.
It's appearing in more than 10 different cities. It's done in big regional theaters and small houses. And this production is going to go to MacArthur Theater in Princeton, and then to Milwaukee Rep. So it's going to keep traveling.
Can I ask you about a stage direction, or maybe it was a description a playwright gave somewhere, saying that the lines really ought to be, they ought to go like this, almost like a situation comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember reading that somewhere? He said that that's kind of the way it ought to roll out.
I don't remember that particular stage direction.
Oh, okay. Well, I read that. I think he was doing an interview with someone who was doing a theater article. Anyway, you made the choice not to do it that way, right?
I think that what I really wanted to investigate was an ability to be honest and truthful on stage and truthful in the acting. And for that, you have to get some very clear road posts along the way, and then allow the actors to be free on stage. That you cannot sort of pack them and tighten them up in such a way that they stop living on stage. Because I think the great power, and for me, the seduction of the piece was that it invites you to a reality that's very human. So I did whatever I had to do, and we did a lot of different exercises to try to achieve that, so that it didn't feel artificial and it didn't feel pushed, but it felt lived in, truthful, real, with a lot of warmth and a lot of heart, and for the actors to be able to sustain that night after night.
How do you, I want to, maybe you know this, Syl, how do you get the actors to, you know, when they've done it when it's this kind of explosive material and they've done it night after night, to still clearly be listening to each other. I mean, I saw that. It's probably mm-hmm. one of the few plays that I've ever had that moment of kind of realization. I could really see them hearing what the other character was saying. I was aware of it in a way that I'm usually not. Is that you? Is that all you?
Well, no, I think it has to do with interpersonal relationships. It has to do with these actors really respecting each other mm-hmm. and really giving and taking from each other in the moment and respecting that act of give and take in the moment and deep listening. So that's a practice. And it's, you know, it doesn't always succeed because you might have one actor in a play that's not doing that and then everybody has to adjust. But if everybody's in the same boat in a way, and it's a bit of a culture, you create a mini culture where these are the principles. We're really listening to each other intently, and we're really present with each other at any given time.
It's hard because they know where it's going to go. Sorry,
well, they
Sel,
do,
go
but
ahead.
But I think too the playwright has done an excellent job of providing lines that cannot be ignored, even in the very beginning when she says to him when he has his pants off, "I only need you from the waist up." I mean, those lines, there's so many lines that have double, triple meaning.
And what she's, just for our listener, what she's doing is drawing him, and she's drawing him from the waist up. But yeah.
But that has resonance later on. So, I mean, it's like you have to listen. I think you have to listen in this play. But your experience as a director would inform that a lot more than mine as a playwright, because you know what actually happens in these rehearsals in terms of what the actors do on the stage.
Well, it's delicate. I think there's a delicate balance. You know, the play is a big puzzle, mm-hmm. and it's a big puzzle of agendas. Everybody's pursuing different things. So we have to respect each other's agendas, but we have to pursue our own very, very strongly. So the balance between those two things is delicate, and it's about orchestration. It's about skill. I mean, these are incredibly skilled performers, mm-hmm. thank God.
I'm curious. You know, you mentioned having to sort of develop a culture of cooperation. I don't remember what word you used, mm-hmm. but did you find, simply from the content of the play, that actors or anybody involved in the work of doing it, that their identity issues were triggered by the content of the play?
I think it's not that they were triggered, but everybody brought their own specific perspective and cultural understanding to the table. And at the same time, curiosity for the specific culture of the characters that they were portraying. So there was a very rich conversation between, yeah. you know, comparing is where am I now and what's been my experience and what's this character's experience. And we had to, you know, the first thing that I said, we're going to step onto each other's toes here. And we have to do it with a spirit of investigation and a spirit of, you know, and an understanding that we have to forgive each other right away and embrace the complexity and the messiness that comes with investigating each other's cultures and other people's cultures.
The play is Disgraced. It runs at the Guthrie through the end of August. Absolutely go see it. And thank you very much for an excellent round.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having
us. Appreciate it.